So this is the fourth in a 22-part series. Go figure that, eh? We got a ways to go. But a series on Jesus' words. And there are ways, I'll say that, of getting a sneak preview of it. But that's how we are. This may be going on for a while. So the first one, we started looking at in Matthew 28, Jesus, just before he ascended, Jesus gave his disciples and also to the church a roadmap of how they were to move forward. And it was explicitly a Jesus-centered operating plan. It was, go and make disciples of me, teach them my words, and I am going to be actively involved and present all through this process. And so we went from there and we started looking at what did Jesus say about then what he said. So what did he say about his words, my words? And he said surprising things about his words. He said, I actually came to speak. That's a really important part of why I came. And these words aren't my words. They're actually self-validating words. If anyone really wants to know the truth about God, they will recognize the truth of the words I speak and recognize that they come from God. And in fact, my followers are going to be very specifically identified by how they respond to my words. His words were, there are some very bold promises about life and fruitfulness and stability, but also there's a challenge. His words are only of benefit if we actually do what he says. And then the next section was connecting what Jesus said about his words to God's earlier words in the Law and the Prophets. So it was my words, the law, and we looked at how Jesus upheld the law, and actually expanded it. The law goes wider and deeper than we might realize. It's not just that final behavior, if you remember from Peter's murderous intent, it's not just the final behavior, it's the law actually addresses everything that leads up to that final behavior. And those simple tests of loving God and others tell us when we have a problem. But the law can never be looked at on its own. It's not meant to be. It must be connected to Jesus. It points them. And one I forgot before is he centralized it. So the law actually speaks to the core of who we are. It's designed to orient our lives around love for God and others. But then it's connected to Jesus. The law is never meant to stand on its own. It's meant to lead us to him. And we find in Jesus the one who fulfills the law. And we find life in him. And it's interesting. I don't think I mentioned it, but I was thinking about it. The law reminds us that the purpose of the gospel is not to escape righteousness, but to find righteousness. And I wonder if sometimes that might affect how we present the gospel. The whole idea of the gospel is not that we can escape being righteous. It's so that we actually can become righteous. And I was thinking about, and I'll say this really quickly, but I've been thinking about how Jesus' words, I think, fit together to give some very simple clarity and confidence. And I'll just mention this really quickly, and I'd love to talk about it more, but there isn't time. So it's this. These two topics that we've looked at about Jesus' words and the law are actually linked to some pretty complex topics. So to illustrate it, let's sort of do a little scenario. So can you picture Jesus giving this commission to his disciples? And he says to them, all authority is given to me in heaven on earth. So go and make disciples, teach them everything that I've commanded you, and most certainly I'm with you always. And then Peter pipes up because Peter is very helpful and he's kind of the one who tries to protect Jesus and correct. And he says, but Lord, I just have this sense that it's not going to be a simple, straightforward thing. Like, this is going to be very confusing as we move forward. Like even among us as disciples, we have some different perspectives on the story, and we're going to, you know, after you're gone, we're going to write it down, but there are going to be some different perspectives in there. And even as we start to form a church, there are going to be the early church, there are going to be challenges. Then we're going to run into manuscript issues that come up. And then as it goes to other cultures, there's going to be cultural miscommunication. There are going to be malicious forces at work, human error, weaknesses. There are going to be heresies. And then you get into translation issues. And then each generation of the church is going to have blind spots. And Lord, did Moses really write the Pentateuch? And so can you picture, you know, Peter with some sort of far-seeing ability saying this to Jesus? And would Jesus then turn to Peter and say, wow, yeah, I hadn't thought of that. What do you think we should do? Or would Jesus turn to Peter and say, Peter, I don't think you understand. All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. So go and make disciples, teach them all that I've commanded you, and most certainly I am with you always right to the end. You see, once you're convinced that Jesus is who he claimed to be, then his words, combined with that confidence in him, gives a framework for working through complexity. And yeah, I'd love to dig into that, but it's worth thinking about. So, the next topic. For this topic, we need to meet the bad guys of the New Testament. So, who are the bad guys of the New Testament? Yes, Danny.
Romans.
Well, Pharisees. Who said the Pharisees? Okay, well, someone said the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the bad guys. Who fought with Jesus the most? Well, it was the Pharisees, and even in the early church, they caused problems. What was it that they argued with Jesus about the most?
One of the other groups was called the Sadducees. They were really bad.
So, but the Sadducees don't show up as much as the Pharisees do. What did they argue with Jesus about? Gina. Okay, that was one of them. Stephen.
The law.
So the law was the thing that Jesus and the Pharisees clashed on most. And so the topic we're going to look at is our righteousness. What did Jesus say about our righteousness and how we tend to respond to God's law? And when Jesus talked about this, like our righteousness and response to the law, it was usually discussed with the Pharisees or in relation to the Pharisees. So all the passages I think that we look at this morning are going to be part of Jesus' conversation with or about the Pharisees. And I'll say some of them, all of these passages will make available at the end. Some of them, for sake of time, I'm just going to quickly read it, but then others I'll say, hey, we're going to sit on this one for a bit and you can look it up. So, for the Pharisees, we really need to understand some history. The Pharisees, let's start with when Israel first started to decline. So in about 930 BC, Israel was divided, you know. Up to Solomon, it was very solid, United Kingdom. With his son, it divided into two. And for the next 300 years, they struggled. Both Israel and Judah struggled, especially spiritually. There was a constant struggle with idolatry. They lost sight of things like the Passover and other celebrations and the Sabbath. They even lost the law. You know, like Josiah, whoa, we found the law. They had lost it. About 300 and some odd years after that, they were finally and completely removed from the land, God's judgment. So that was about 600 BC. It happened in stages, first Israel to Assyria, and then several stages of Judah being taken to Babylon, roughly 600 BC. And they lost the temple, and when you lose the temple, you lose the sacrifices too. And it was probably somewhere in there that the idea of the synagogue developed. And the synagogue was sort of a decentralized temple replacement. Instead of sacrifices, it would be study of the law and prayer and so on. If any, you might even think of it as it became sort of a personal relationship with God. 70 years later, they returned. So 70 years after the first deportation, I believe it was, there was a first return. And then 70 years after the temple was destroyed, the temple was rebuilt. And so by the time you get to around 400 BC, the city is mainly rebuilt, the wall is rebuilt, temple, sacrifice, there's a refocus on the law, and in a sense the Old Testament canon is closed. And there is about 400 years of what we talk about as science. It's interesting that when Israel returned to the land, they returned in many ways as different people. I remember reading a phrase, and it always stuck in my mind. When they returned to the land, they were permanently cured of idolatry. And certainly in the form of idolatry that they had practiced, they were. Perhaps there are other ways. But it was never again in that form again. And there was a renewed focus on the law and feasts and so on. And you can see that the way at Jesus' day, the way the Passover and feasts were celebrated, it was like no other time in Israel's history before. You know, I remember, is it Hezekiah, that it said they celebrated the Passover, and not even in David's day had there been such a wholehearted celebration of the Passover. Well, at Jesus' time of Jesus, they were really celebrating. They kept everything like clockwork. And you can see that, sort of, for example, in the Maccabeans. There was an intensity about holding to the law and the sacrifices and so on. There was pressure, perhaps in a different form. So it was the Hellenization, the Greek culture around them. And there was a real temptation and push to just sort of adopt the Greek culture to fit in. So in that sense, very much like us today. But there was a group at that time called the Hasidim, which they were sort of like the Puritans. It means holy ones who pushed back against Hellenization. And that word always stuck in my mind. It was sort of like if you hit your hand, your thumb with a hammer, you could say, Hasidim! You know, it just sounds appropriate, but you're actually saying holy ones. Anyway, so the Hasidim were a group that were pushing back against this Hellenization, and the Pharisees came out of this group. The Pharisees were very focused on studying the law and the prophets, and also the traditions that had grown up around the law. And these traditions were sort of like a fence to protect and apply the law. So in some ways it was, yes, it was a tradition, but it was there for a, you might say, a really good purpose. They were extremely precise, perhaps reacting to their problems in the past. So for example, Israel really struggled with keeping the Sabbath. So for the Pharisees, they were very precise on the Sabbath. So some wouldn't spit on the ground because, you see, if you spit with enough force, the dirt might splatter up, and that's plowing, and you are not to plow on the Sabbath. And women ought not to look in the mirror on Sabbath because they might be tempted to pluck out a gray hair, and that is work too. They also had these very complex loopholes. So because there's complex restrictions, and so there's loopholes as well. So you couldn't carry clothes, but there are situations where you could wear multiple layers of clothes and then take them off. And you couldn't walk more than a kilometer, but you could, on the day before, leave sort of a cache of food 1 kilometer away, and then that becomes your home away from home. So you could walk 1 kilometer, and then you could walk 1 kilometer beyond that, and that was okay. You know? So it wasn't easy being a Pharisee, you know. And at the time of Jesus, they were the most influential group. They were very much the ones who led in the synagogues. So there was an influence among the people. And they were admired by the people. And perhaps they were a key part of keeping the Jews from the old patterns of idolatry and the new challenges of remaining distinct from the culture around them. So here's the odd thing. Jesus and the Pharisees both valued the law. Don't you find it surprising that they disagreed so adamantly? If the Pharisees were the back-to-the-Bible group of the time, why did Jesus clash with them to such an extent? I mean, they seem to be so much further ahead than the Jews in previous days. So why didn't Jesus just sort of work with them and tweak their approach? It's almost as though, imagine church history, and let's say the church goes through a time that the Bible is forgotten and it becomes very liberal, and then there's a group that comes and restores the church and makes the scripture central. And then Jesus comes and he criticizes that group the most. Like, seems a little odd. So what was it that Jesus said about the Pharisees? What was it he said was their problem? Andy?
They were concerned about things that they should not be concerned with.
Yeah.
The more weighty things, they ignored.
Okay. What did he call them? Yeah.
Like whitewashed tombs.
That's right, and hypocrites. So a hypocrite is actually came from that time. Like it was the word for an actor, because in the Greek plays, the actors would have these masks that they would hold in front of their faces. So you would look at them and you'd see this mask, but it was a very different person underneath. And so that's the idea of a hypocrite. You see something on the outside, but what's inside is very different. So I'll read to you what Jesus said in Matthew 23, starting verse 4. He talked about them. He said, "They tie up heavy loads, hard to carry, put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing even to lift a finger to move them. They do all their deeds to be seen by people. For they make their phylacteries wide, their boxes to hold their memory verses in, and their tassels long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the best seats in synagogues and elaborate greetings in the marketplace and to have people call them rabbi." So the end result is they became self-centered, preoccupied with appearances, and they actually harmed others in the process. So here's an kind of a question that comes out of that. How did they end up there as hypocrites and that self-centered, preoccupied with appearances and actually harming others from such a good starting point? Like, they started with knowing, protecting, and applying God's law to avoid the errors of the past. So how did they end up being there? So another way you could say it is, how do you become a hypocrite? So what did you learn at church today? You're going to learn how to become a hypocrite. Doesn't sound good, does it? So what I'd like to do is, and this isn't complete, I don't think, but three things that Jesus said about them or to them that perhaps explain what happened. The first one, and you can turn to this, is in Mark 7, because it's a little bit longer. So Mark 7, and Jesus it's almost like he's, if you go to, say, a doctor or physio or talk to Ali about massage, and you say, "My foot's sore." And what they do is they start sort of analyzing it, sort of thinking out loud. And they say, well, here's here's what happened. You injured your foot, and then your body compensated, and the muscles tightened up, and they sort of give you this quick diagnosis, and much of it doesn't make sense because they're giving you that diagnosis. Here's what's happened, you know, so that you understand. And in a sense, Jesus does that. So in Mark 7, he starts. The context is they're talking about one of these issues, washing hands. And in verse 6, this is what he says to them about them. He said to them, "Isaiah prophesied correctly about you, hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me.'" So there's that idea of hypocrite. You know, the mask is, you know, honor me with their lips, but your heart is far from me. So it's like a skin deep righteousness. It looks good on the outside, but it's hollow underneath. Then verse 7, it says, "They worship me in vain, teaching as doctrine the commands of men. Having no regard for the command of God, you hold fast to human tradition." So they have no regard. It's the idea of you forsake or lay aside the command of God, but you hold fast to something else. So there was some kind of a substitution that was going on. And then in verse 9, he said, "You neatly reject the command of God in order to set up your tradition." Reject has that idea of neutralize or set aside. And then he goes and gives them an example of how they are doing it. And then later on, verse 13, he says, "Thus you nullify the word of God, or you make no effect by your tradition that you have handed down. And you do many things like this." So the things that they added in alongside the law began to function as substitutes. They took the place of the law. It deflected the law, nudged it aside. It's sort of like they remade the law in their own image. So I'm going to show you an example. Alec, can you come up? So if you stand there, then on the camera they can see. So Alec, can you punch into that? No heart. Okay. So I'm going to ask Alec to punch me. Okay? No problem. You know, I'm the dad. When he punches me, there's lots of things I can do. Okay? I can just stand there and don't do it yet. I can let him punch me. I can punch him back. I can run away. There are lots of things I can do. And it's sort of like that with the law. There's, when God sort of punches at us with the law, there's lots of things we can do. We can hit back. We can just take it and we can run away. Lots of things we can do. What am I going to do? Okay. Go ahead, punch me. Okay. So, what did I do? I deflected it. What I did is I just nullified it. It didn't hurt me at all. If he had really been doing it, and if I was really good at it, he would actually be thrown off balance. But I nullified it because I just deflected it. Thanks for not punching me. And in a sense, like, God intends for the law to knock us down for our own good. And what they did is they deflected it. Because they deflected it, like, and does that make sense? You know, if you put up something else and just kind of nudge the law aside, you neutralize it without putting it down. I didn't stop Alec from punching me, but just neutralized it. Because they deflected the law, they missed the core of it. So if you turn to Matthew 23, And this gets at what Micah is saying. Matthew 23, verse 23, he says, "Woe to you, experts in the law, and you Pharisees, hypocrites! You give a tenth of mint, dill, and cumin. You know, so your garden herbs, you tithe even that, you know? So I'm picking my mint. One sprig for God, nine sprigs for me." That's literally what they would do. So very precise. God says we tithe, we are going to tithe. "Yet you neglect what is more important in the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have done these things without neglecting the others." So they would tithe their garden herbs, but forget justice and mercy, which was the second command. You know, love your neighbor. And they deflected that. They deflected it and missed the core of it. In Luke, when the Luke's account of this, it actually says you neglect the love for God. So they missed the first command too. So their religion that developed drifted from God and harmed others because it missed the core of what the law was about. And then a little further in Matthew, verse 25, it says, "Woe to you, experts in the law, and you Pharisees, hypocrites! You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they're full of greed and self-indulgence." They would... And then he goes on to say, "Woe to you, experts! You are like whitewashed tombs that look beautiful on the outside, but inside you are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean." They deflected it, they missed the core, and then they covered up the problem. The outside of the dish is washed, but nothing has changed on the inside. Just like a shiny tombstone may hide the fact that it's about death. So they deflected the power with a substitute. It looked similar, sounded good. They majored in the minors, missed what was most important, but poured efforts into looking right, and so they covered over the problem and became hypocrites. And after fooling others for long enough, they actually fooled themselves. And I think there's a warning for us. There's an indirect warning simply because it's talked about so much in the Gospels, and the Gospels are recording things that I think we need to hear. But it's also direct too, because Jesus said to his disciples on at least two occasions, watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees. And it's interesting, yeast is, you just need a little bit in a recipe and it works its way. And it's like Jesus is saying, it doesn't take a lot of that yeast to affect everything. So the Pharisees, I think, illustrated dangerous error in general about our righteousness and how we can approach God's law. Just that tendency to deflect, miss the core, and cover up. So how might this appear for us? It can be things that are an outward precision, like simply, hey, I go to meeting every week, or turning your Bible reading into a point system. Those things like that, good things, can become our version of tithing herbs and Sabbath rules. It can happen in other ways too. One of the big things today is it's all about love, you know, and I think what that does is it deflects, uses the second command to deflect the first. Without the first to align my love with God's, I can do whatever I want, and in love, let others do the same. You see, like, there's lots of ways. In all cases, we have an achievable law, and God's law is made ineffective or deflected. And I wonder too, I don't have time to go into it, but I wonder too if it can happen more generally too in the North American church at large. It's not just laws that we feel need to be added in. Do our tools and systems and concepts and videos and programs and teachers and growth strategies and theology and books edge in front. We add a lot today, and it's so much more available than ever before. It almost makes you wonder, how could people ever mature as Christians at all in previous generations without these things? So there are many good things that can become our focus or the organizing prince of our life and deflect what God says. Stephen sent me something, and I just leave as things to mull over. But he sent me, there was a dialogue, and he mentioned about a respected church leader who ended up doing some surprisingly deceptive things as he dealt with COVID challenges. And it's interesting, it's a hypocrisy that didn't come from adding laws, but I think a more general deflecting of God's way, and COVID just exposed it. Anyway, something to mull over. But where Jesus diagnoses, he also prescribes. And there are three things that I think Jesus talks about. One is, he says, so if he's a physiotherapist, he says, let me tell you, here are three things that led to this problem. Here are three things that can cure hypocrisy in the process leading to it. One is, he gives us something we need to realize, just something very simple to realize. In Luke 16, he said to the Pharisees, he said, you are the ones who justify yourselves in the sight of others, but God knows your hearts. What is highly admired by people is revolting in God's sight. He was talking with them about money. And he says, you're seeking to justify yourself. You're caught up with proving something to yourself and others. And you apparently forget that God sees the inside. He sees your hearts. He knows what's real. And he values quite differently. In another place in Luke 11, he said, you fools, didn't the one who made the outside make the inside as well? There's something about hypocrisy that's just pitifully foolish. There's a lot of effort to put on a mask, but God isn't fooled at all. It's in a sense just so simple. It's just remembering that God exists and he knows, and it makes hypocrisy look ridiculous. It's just that simple concept of what faith is in the first place. It's that simple realization that God exists and is active. So Hebrews 11:6 said, without faith, it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. And that simple confidence that God exists and he is active makes many things clear. It makes things clear with fear and prayer and what worship is and so on. I was going to read a story, and I don't have time, but just that a missionary told about a very simple prayer that a young girl made in Africa. And it was just the simple faith of a child that says, God exists, and he's active. And you read it, and you say, wow, he is. Maybe that's why Jesus said children get it better than adults do often, because it's just that faith is just that simple confidence that God exists, and he is active. That's it. Love to read it. Maybe we'll send it out in the questions. Jesus said in John 5, he said, how can you believe if you accept praise from one another and don't seek the praise that comes from the only God? Like, what kind of faith is it that allows us to live preoccupied with what others think instead of God. Like, oh, what kind of faith is that? It's you might call it faith, but it's functionally atheism. How can you believe if you don't seek the praise that comes from the only God? It's there's something very simple. It's an upside down solution. If you're struggling with hypocrisy, you don't start fixing yourself. You get a right view of God, and that kind of helps to fix you. So the one is realize something very simple. God exists, and he knows. Second thing is he gives us an exercise to do. So like a physiotherapist, he says, here's an exercise. I want you to do this exercise 3 times a day. And it's in Matthew 6. And here's what he says. Be careful not to display your righteousness merely to be seen by people. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father in heaven. Thus, whenever you do charitable giving, do not blow a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in synagogues and on streets so that people praise them. I tell you the truth, they have their reward. But when you do your giving, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your gift may be in secret. And your Father, who sees in secret, will reward you. Whenever you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, because they love to pray while standing in synagogues and on street corners, so that people see them. Truly I say to you, they have their reward. But whenever you pray, go into your inner room, close the door, and pray to your Father in secret. And your Father, who sees in secret, will reward you. So if the first one is to realize that God is and he sees and knows, then the second is just the exercise of, you know, not just these specific examples, but it's a general principle. Do things that only God sees. Just an antidote to hypocrisy is to, you might say, intentionally choose obscurity. It's that discipline of being unseen, doing things that no one else will see except for God, and do it for him. There's a song that Elner introduced to me years ago, and the concept didn't start, it was Sarah Groves. And the concept, I don't think, started with her, but it's has the idea of living for an audience of one. And there's a phrase, and now I live, I breathe for an audience of one. The idea that my life is on display, and your life too, for an, imagine the concert hall, and your life is on stage, and there's not anybody else in the audience, there's one in the audience. It's God. There was one time I was leading the praise night years and years ago, and maybe it was kind of a dumb idea, but it was at the time that I was thinking about this. And when people came in, instead of all the chairs being out there, all the chairs were up here, and there was one chair in the middle of the room. And the idea was we would all sit up here and sing to the one chair. And so maybe it was kind of a dumb idea, but for me, it was a way of trying to say, as I'm singing this, as we're doing it to an audience of one. That's why we're doing it. And so there's some homework for today. Do something 3 times a day. How's that? Or however, that only God sees. Just do things that only God sees. And last, sorry, I'm breaking Peter's record for going over. I think I do it more often than Peter, maybe. Lastly, Jesus introduced a system to cure hypocrisy in the process leading up to it. He talked about, he was saying to the woman at the well, an hour is coming now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. Time is coming and now here. He says it's change is coming. It's right at the door. And it sounds like a cure for hypocrisy. Worshippers who worship God in spirit and truth, like solid and true, real people. It sounds like hypocrisy is cured, but how? How does that, what is the cure for hypocrisy? And I was going to read these verses and kind of play a trick on you. I was going to say, I'm going to read these verses and tell me what is the system you see in it? Because Jesus has a system. He says in John 8, he says, I have much to say about you and much to judge, but he who sent me is true, and I declare to the world what I have heard from him. What's the system Jesus describes? John 9, he says to the Pharisees, for judgment I have come into this world so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind. If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin, but now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains. What's the system? Well, there is no system. It's Jesus. He says, I have much to say to you. Jesus is the system. He's the, when he says, I have much to say and much to judge, it's sort of like he's saying, there's a long physio program ahead of you. But I'm the key to leading you through that. And in John 9, he talks about that change is going to come through him. He doesn't give a system that works apart from him. Stay close. And, I'm going to cut that short. But here's the core of the gospel. The good news is not a process. There's nothing. Jesus didn't come to give us a system that works apart from him. There is none. He came to give us himself, and we need him. And he is the cure for hypocrisy and all that leads up to it. So just to wrap up, the natural follow-up to Jesus' words about the law is Jesus' words about our righteousness, how we respond or measure up to the challenge of God's law. And I think the Pharisees are that living example or the living case study of our righteousness at its worst. Even in being so right, they were so wrong. I think there are many ways we can respond to God's law, but maybe the sneakiest is deflecting. And so part of Jesus' diagnosis is that our problem is that deflect, miss, and cover cycle. It's easy to deflect God's words with additions or substitutes, and in the process miss the core things and then cover up the problem. Deflect, miss, and cover. And Jesus' prescription is, in some ways, it's very simple. Remember that God sees and knows. Intentionally do things that only God sees, and stay close to Jesus for a complete cure. So homework? Yeah, there's got to be homework. What difference does God's reality make? How do you live out that audience of one and do things that only God sees and stay close to Jesus? You can do that. You know, maybe part of that could be reading a chapter from the Gospels every day. And just that can be part of staying close to him. So let's pray. Father, thank you for your commitment to work with us, your plans for what you want to do in salvation is so much more than so much more. Thank you that you fully intend to rescue us from sin, and thank you that in Jesus there is a way. Please help us to live out these things this week. In Jesus' name, amen.